Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sansarema, your host of the channel, and we'll be talking to Klaus-Dieter Matthies and Michael Sheehy today. We have two editors here, which will be wonderful, about their book called The Other Emptiness, Rethinking Ni Shintung Buddhist Discourse in Tibet, published by Sunny Press. So, yes, welcome, both of you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, welcome, and thanks for doing this recording for us.
Yes, Sarang Sambal, thanks so much for inviting us on.
Yeah, no, I've been very excited about this for a long time, so it's great to have you both here. So I think, tell us a bit about yourself. Let's start with Klaus. Just kind of a bit about your background.
Yeah, since early on, when I was studying Buddhism, I was interested in models of reality to explain the new findings in modern physics, what we have in quantum physics, for example, with a double slit experiment, the entanglement and the wave particle like duality. And I was a little bit frustrated when I looked to Western philosophy. So I started studying Buddhism. And soon I found out you cannot just work with interpreters. And you have to learn yourself Tibetan and talk to Tibetan learned masters directly in their own language. And then I found out you have to do Sanskrit on top of that. And so I took up my studies of Tibetan and Indian studies and with a focus on Tibetan Buddhist philosophy. And since the very beginning, I was interested in questions of emptiness, dependent arising, what is left over in emptiness, if there is at all something left. And so, at some point I met Kenpo Tsultim Gyamtso Rinpoche, and I was really inspired by his teaching and his also like emphasis of Shen Tong or like the empty of other like approach to emptiness. And he made me study the Maitreya works and told me to do like research on Shen Tong. So that's how I got started to work on this topic. And I'm glad that I met Michael Sheehy. That was, I think, when we started to talk about this project, that was at the IEPS conference in Taiwan, wasn't it, Michael? And then or even before, I had organized a panel on Shen Tong at the IS conference in Vancouver. And then Michael did another conference a year later in Taiwan at the IEPS conference. And then we thought like it would be good to have a book project. But I think we have to credit at this point Michel Martin, who first had the idea of this book and also established the contacts with Sunny.
So it's really a realization of quite a long project.
We have been working for many years on that. Normally, it should be more fast to publish a book like that. But then again, you know, when you look at the list of the authors, it's like all like very important like scholars working in the field of Shen Tong published in this book. And that's quite an achievement to have people like Matthew Kapstein, Dojie Wangchuck, and all these important scholars who have something to say or something important to contribute. They could publish, or we convinced them to publish in this volume.
Yes, yes.
That's very unique.
Yes, so it's a very exciting volume. And Michael, what about you?
So I began my interest in Buddhism and Buddhist studies really as a kind of a child. I became very interested in meditation and understanding Asian medicine and modalities of treatment and kind of contemplative methods and so forth. And then when I went to college, it became very clear to me that I could study this, and I found that very exciting. So I spent my undergraduate studying Buddhist studies and Asian religions. And during that time, went to India and Nepal and started to travel in Japan and Asia elsewhere. And after graduating undergraduate, I went back to India for a few years to study and to learn the languages. I knew I wanted to learn Tibetan at that time and had already begun to do so. And then by the time I went to graduate school in Buddhist studies, I really became very interested in issues around the nature of mind and what it is about the contemplative traditions, Buddhist in general, but really Tibetan contemplative traditions, that was theorized from, or at least supposedly theorized in philosophical language about contemplative experience. And, in so doing, in studying Madhyamaka and Yogacara and so forth, really came to Tibetan interpretations of that. And I was very much studying kind of Nyingma Kagyu interpretations at that time and was sort of on a path to do a dissertation probably in sort of Dzogchen veins of thought. But I had a friend of mine when I was in graduate school who was in India. She came back and she said, "Oh, I met this Lama and he came from Tibet and he gave me this book and I promised him that I would translate it." And I said, "Oh, that's cool. There's lots of Lamas coming from Tibet into India and da da da." And she said, "No, like, I don't know what to do with it." And she gave it to me because she knew I was a graduate student learning Tibetan. And I said, "Yeah, that's cool." And I just kind of put it on the shelf. I remember very distinctly the shelf in my kitchen there, my bookshelf, and thought nothing of it, just let it sort of collect dust. And then one morning I went and I picked it up and I started to read it. And it was by a Kenpo from a Jonang monastery in Zamtang in eastern Tibet, in Amdo, who had come to India and he had written this book and published it in India, in Tibetan. And it was on philosophy and the history of all what he called the five schools or traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, including the Jonang. And I just thought this was fantastically interesting. I had been aware of Matthew Kapstein's work and other things that have been published largely out of Nipom's thought on Zhentong at that time, but hadn't really thought about that too seriously. So I started to read that little booklet, and then I ended up going to India. And in so doing, I met one of the senior, really elder masters of the Jonang tradition who had been in India at that time just traveling. And through happenstance, I ended up spending several months with him. And at one point in conversations, he turned and he looked to me and he said, "Well, if you really want to study this, you have to come to Tibet." And the kind of subtext there was like, nobody here understands this stuff, right? Like, because there were really no Jonang Lamas, very few in exile. And we were actually at Shimla at the monastery, which is the headquarters of the Jonang in India at the time. And I said, "Okay." So I went and spent the next 3 years in Golok in a monastery, a Jonang monastery in eastern Tibet. And I started to study this kind of wholeheartedly and intensively. and my dissertation ended up on, on the Jonang and so forth. So that's how I became immersed in sort of Jonang and Zhentong thinking.
Yeah. So I guess you both have a background in the Kagyu, and then you branched off at some point because of this auspicious coincidence.
Well, I have to add that Kempo Sildam Gyamso made me study the works of Dolpopa right away. And of course, I got also interested in Jonang studies. And I'm traveling to Eastern Tibet, to Amdo, and meet like Jonang Kempos. We had invited Khenpo Rinpoche for a full semester as a visiting professor to Vienna 3 years ago to teach on Kala Chakra and Zhentong, how Zhentong view can be justified on the basis of Kala Chakra. And we are also working in a current project with Kempos in Tsamtang and in Golok also. So, we have a lot of, in common, so to say, Michael and I.
Yeah, definitely. So, Klaus, you already said a little bit about how this book manifested in the form it is. This all began in Taiwan, right? How long ago was that? Tell us a bit more.
Yeah, I had to correct myself. It started in Vancouver, in fact. It's in 2010, we had a conference of the International Association of Tibetan Studies, and I had organized a panel on Zhentong. And a few of the contributors to the volume were there at the panel. And then just a year later at the International Association of Buddhist Studies conference in Taiwan, Michael had organized a similar panel on Zhentong. And then some who were there in Vancouver were again in the panel in Taiwan. And then we started to have the idea to publish the papers we read, and also invite other important scholars who work in the field of Zhentong. And then that's how the whole project started. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you want to know more about the history of how the book was produced.
No, that's okay. I think we can jump right into the book. So I think the thing that really struck me was, like he's already mentioned, the number of scholars who are involved in this project, and also the fact that this is the newest thing that's trying to engage with the Rantum Zhentong argument, which has been a huge problem debate for many, many years. So, yeah, I guess we can jump right into the book and tell us a bit more about the contents.
Okay, fair enough. I think it's important to say something about the Rantong-Zhentong distinction a bit. It's not so much about that there are some sources, like the sutra, some sutras or some treatises, some tantras, which support the view that there is something left in emptiness, that there is something existing ultimately, which is empty of other, which does not belong to it. But the point is that we have two different competing models of hermeneutics. So one is following mainly the hermeneutics of Chandrakirti, and the other one follows the hermeneutics of the Yogacara and Tathagatagarbha school. That's mainly based on the Sandinyamochana Sutra, and where three cycles of teaching are propounded. And so this opposition between Rantong and Zhentong, or self-empty and other-empty, can be traced back to India, to the beginning of the Yogacara school, and then the reaction of the Madhyamakas to the Yogacara school. Michael, do you like to add in something, or shall I just...
No, that's great. You know, I think just the conception of the book was really to bring together these international collaborators. I think there's 11 authors, including Klaus and myself, and they're really leaders in the field. I mean, there's very few scholars who have been publishing on Zhentong. As we begin our book, in the introduction that Klaus and I co-authored, really there's been a preponderance of scholarship in English language and arguably Western languages on Rantong presentations of emptiness, as if that is the exclusive, almost, as it's largely been presented, understanding of what emptiness is, according to Tibetans and even from the Indian canonical literature. And yet that's not the case in Tibet, and it's not the case amongst Tibetan thinkers historically. So what we do in this, what this book does is a kind of collaboration of scholars, is brings these different voices and perspectives into conversation about what is Zhentong, about the multiplicities of Zhentong, about the diversities and varieties of Zhentong philosophical thinking. And in so doing, really hopefully complements and kind of enriches our understanding, our fuller kind of intellectual history of what emptiness is, presentations of emptiness have been, over the last 1,000 years in Tibet.
That's correct. Yes, I notice how you cover all of the different traditions, and all these wonderful authors from the Tibetan history are covered also.
Yeah, and maybe I like to add that the Tibetan discussion about Shantong and Rangtong is a continuation of what we had already in India. And so we can look at the Sandinamochana Sutra and the definition of the three Dharma chakras, the three wheels of teaching, and how they define them. And we have on the one hand the Yogacara school, which says that the third Dharma chakra, the third wheel of teaching, which contains Yogacara works and Tathagatagarbha works or Buddha nature works, is a definitive meaning. And that means that the idea prevails that Buddha nature ideas, that Shantong ideas, were the final intention of the Buddha. So that means that the whole corpus of the Buddhist teaching, including Madhyamaka and everything else, needs to be interpreted against the background of the Sandinamochana Sutra and the Shantong interpretation. Whereas the other camp, those who follow Chandrakirti, they criticize the Sandinamochana Sutra and find fault with Yogacara, with the Yogacara tenet, such that they claim a cutoff potential, that a big group of sentient beings cannot attain Buddhahood at all, or that they claim the ultimate existence of something dependently arising, which is philosophically not possible according to the Madhyamaka school. And then they argue, in line with Dharmakirti, or based on Dharmakirti, how can you follow the hermeneutic of a sutra which has so serious faults? And then the reaction was, well, sorry, but the Yogacara system doesn't have these faults. Yeah? So we are not claiming the ultimate existence of the dependent nature, and we don't really mean that a big group of sentient beings is completely cut off the possibility to attain a Buddha, because everybody has a Buddha nature and everybody has a fundamental natural potential. So these kind of discussions were going on since the 6th and 7th century, or even earlier. And I could go a little bit more into detail and how the Chonangpas and the Shantongpas defended their hermeneutics, which is quite interesting. And you find that in the introduction of our book. And I don't know whether you want to have a summary of that or not, but maybe. Yeah, it's what Chandrakirti does is in his Madhyamaka Avatara, which is his main Madhyamaka work, he criticizes the Yogacara school and the Yogacara tenet. And basically, he uses the Madhyamaka argument for that things cannot arise from other. Yeah, that means, that if something is really separate, then it cannot function as a cause. So if causes and effects are completely separate from each other, if they exist inherently in an independent way, there can be no mutual interaction, and so there cannot be an arising from other. And based on this argument, Chandrakirti refutes the Yogacara model of reality, which claims that there is a dependent nature. And then, and that's even more interesting now, is that he explains why the Buddha was teaching the Yogacara all the same. And his hermeneutics start. And he explains that, there is a need to encourage students who would turn away from Buddhism if you taught them that everything is empty of an own nature. So in order to encourage them, you need to tell them, well, don't worry, you have a Buddha nature. And then that means that the teaching of a Buddha nature and on which our Shentong doctrine is based would have only provisional meaning. You would tell it only students who are frightened of the profound and deep understanding of emptiness. And then he quotes the Lankavatara Sutra. And the way you find in the Lankavatara Sutra a dialogue between the Bodhisattva Mahamati and the Buddha, and Mahamati asks the Buddha, well, why did you teach Buddha nature, and which is endowed with all the different qualities? Isn't that a heretic teaching? Isn't that similar to what the non-Buddhists say? And then you have this statement, thinking of emptiness and non-arising and wishlessness and so on, I was making use of the word Buddha nature in order to not turn away or frighten students who are afraid of emptiness. Now, Chandrakirti takes this part, this passage, as a proof that the teaching of Buddha nature has only provisional meaning, and that the Buddha was thinking of emptiness when he was teaching Buddha nature. But when you look at the passage carefully in the Lankavatara, it does not say that the teaching of Buddha nature has provisional meaning. It only says that there you find an equation of Buddha nature with emptiness. And now the question arises, does the Lankavatara Sutra teach the Madhyamaka emptiness of Chandrakirti, or does it rather teach another form of emptiness? And when you look at the Lankavatara Sutra, it is clear that it's mainly teaching Yogacara emptiness, that its main tenet is the three nature theory. And there is one passage in the Lankavatara which introduces to a sevenfold distinction of emptiness. And it says, well, because you are too much attached different items, we have to, because you are too much attached to what is the imagined nature, we have to make use of the words non-arising and emptiness and so on. So it's clear that the Lankavatara somehow restricts the validity of emptiness or understands emptiness in terms of the imagined nature. And then, it continues and gives different types of emptiness. And what is quite interesting in this whole discussion is the seventh emptiness. It speaks of an inferior emptiness, the emptiness of the one from the other. And the Lankavatara uses a formula, something like which X is not found in which Y, that Y is empty of X. Or to put it in another word, in this room, there is no elephant, hence this room is empty of an elephant. Now, you have this formula also in Yogacara and Tathagatagarbha. And in Yogacara, it says that the dependent is empty of the imagined. And in Buddha nature theory, you have the idea that Buddha nature is empty of the adventitious stains. But the main difference to the Lankavatara is when the Lankavatara Sutra is teaching the emptiness of the one from the other, then gives us an example, a place in the jungle, which is not empty of monks, but it is empty of elephants and other animals. And that means, that a particular place is empty of a particular animal. But to say this place in the jungle is empty of elephants doesn't mean that elephants don't exist at all. I mean, you find elephants in the zoo or in Africa. It's only a particular place where no elephants exist. But in Yogacara, you have like wherever you are in the universe, wherever you have a dependently arising mind, it's always empty of the subject-object duality. And wherever you have Buddha nature, it's always empty of adventitious stains. So even though the formula of emptiness is very similar, you cannot say that the meaning is the same. So you cannot say that Yogacara and Buddha nature emptiness is the inferior emptiness of the Lankavatara. And the Chonankas, they point out there is another emptiness in this list, which says that the wisdom of the noble ones is empty of defilements and the imprints, the mental imprints of the defilements. So that would qualify much more for as a proper form of emptiness. So what I'm saying is the Lankavatara Sutra's idea of emptiness is not what Chandrakirti understands as emptiness. And when the Lankavatara equates Buddha nature with emptiness, basically does not establish a Madhyamaka emptiness of Buddha nature, but has an idea that something like a luminosity or Buddha nature is empty of other of the imagined nature or the adventitious stains. But when you look at the Lankavatara in this way, it does not follow that Buddha nature has only provisional meaning. And there is one other Chandrakirti then also quotes another part from the Lankavatara where he says, the Buddha has taught mind only as a medicine for those who are too much attached to external material objects. Now, if you read only this verse, which is quoted by Chandrakirti, you would agree. You say, there are some students, they have very strong attachments, so you need a very strong medicine for them. Okay, you tell them everything is mind only. So when you only look at this verse, you would agree with Chandrakirti and think, well, the Yogacara teaching of mind only has provisional meaning. But when you go to the Lankavatara Sutra, and nobody is really doing that, except maybe the Chonankas, and the next verse, it says, the teaching of mind only is very difficult to understand. It cannot be understood by the philosophers, and it cannot be understood by the followers of the small vehicle, the Shravakas. And the Buddha is teaching from his own experience. So if you just read the next verse in the Lankavatara, it is clear that the mind-only teaching and thus the main tenet of the Yogacara school has definitive meaning and is not a provisional teaching. So you could, just by going back to the sutras and the different material, like Chandrakirti quotes, and analyzing this material, you can find fault with Chandrakirti. And this is precisely what the Chonankas did. They just went back to the sutras and just read the Lankavatara Sutra. And you know that Chandrakirti is not quoting properly in this point. But the Rangtongkas, they just follow Chandrakirti and Chandrakirti's analysis. And the whole analysis is not questioned anymore because nobody in Tibet really goes back to the sutras except the Chonankas.
Yes, I was just going to ask, how does that play out on the basis of this in some of the sources that were covered by the contributors in your book?
Yeah, so, as Klaus has so eloquently explained, we have all of the source literature, Indic Sanskrit source literature, the sutras and the five works of Maitreya. And as these were translated into Tibetan and received by Tibetans, there are problems that are also received by the Tibetans and how to interpret this. And there are histories of these problems and paradoxes and histories of these paradoxes. And in the reception of these materials into Tibetan, of not only texts, but ideas and philosophical problems and paradoxes and puzzles, we find Tibetans finding different ways to work through these problems. And in so doing, coming up with different hermeneutical techniques, right? Interpretive techniques, different methods to think through these problems and configure them in new and creative ways. So this project has really sought out people who've been working on thinkers, Tibetan thinkers, who've been thinking through in really creative ways through the history of Tibetan thought, some of these issues around these two modes of emptiness, rangtong on the one hand being that of inherent empty nature, and zhentong of the other, meaning that things are empty of everything other than the luminous, continuous nature of the mind and of Buddha nature and so forth. So, you know, we begin with David Higgins, who has this paper on early Dzogchen and Nyingma thinking around the concept of Bodhigarbha. And there's some very creative thinking at that time, this kind of inception period, the early phase of the reception of Indic ideas into Tibet and the Nyingma buzz, early Nyingma buzz. And then we have a paper by Tsering Wangchuk, who explores Rigpa Ralchri and some of the ideas around what we can call sort of proto-Zhentong ideas that get formulated at Nartong Gompa and with a whole series of thinkers, including Chomden Rigpa Ralchri, who's, you know, 13th century, and Jotom Munlam Sultram, who are inheriting, again, lineages or streams of interpretation from the five treatises of Maitreya and so forth, coming through Senkawoche and so forth. Next, we have a paper by myself on Dolpopa's hermeneutics and how he had really framed Zhentong and used language of Zhentong, Rangtong, and other Dharmic vocabulary to specify these concepts in really discrete and clear ways, but also how he saw Zhentong as being part of a larger language, Dharmic language, for modeling his understanding of reality, for the nature of reality. And that's deeply embedded in time and space for him, and also text, right? Canonical source literature for him, primarily the Kala Chakra Tantra and its commentarial tradition, as well as the sutric sources that Klaus alluded to. And next we have Dorje Nyingcha, who offers this really critical piece on one of Dolpopa's students' texts that has been recently recovered from the deep archives inside Tibet, inside central Tibet, and it was lost. And it's a very rare manuscript that came out over the last, over the last two decades. And Dorje Nyingcha recovers this text from Garong Le Jiaotsen, who's one of Dolpopa's primary disciples. But the text is a polemical text in which he is actually in conversation and actually in debate with Remdawa, and with thinkers like Tsong Kapa's mentor. And it captures these kind of polemical back and forth issues between what becomes Gelugpa's and Jonangpa's at this critical moment in the intellectual history there in the late 14th, early 15th century. And then next we have a paper by Klaus in which he goes through and unpacks Zhentong views in the Karmakagya tradition. And that's followed by a paper by Martina Drazetsky, who again unpacks thinkers in the Kagyu tradition who have been really critical in formulating ideas around Zhentong. We have the eighth Karmapa, Mikyo Dorje, who's well known, but also the first Karmapa, first Karma Trinley, the seventh Karmapa, Chujak Yamso, the second Jarmapa, Kachu Wangpo, and so forth. So Martina goes through in her contribution and unpacks them and really brings them to light. Next, we have a chapter on Shakya Chogden's interpretation by Yaroslav Komorowski, who's done a lot of work on Shakya Chogden, and brings Shakya Chogden's unique view into the conversation, which is a really critical moment again in the history of Zhentong thinking, because it was often thought that until Shakya Chogden's works were recovered in the late 20th century, this was a blackout period and that there were not authors, particularly Sakya authors, who wrote on Zhentong. But we now know that that's not the case. And then we have, again, following chronologically in order here, another paper by Klaus in which he illuminates Taranatha's text in his paper on Dolpopa and Shakya Chogden's views. That really is a Tibetan making sense of disparate Tibetan views of Zhentongpas. Again, a kind of fascinating piece. And then next we have Matthew Kapstein, who contributes a piece on Nyingma interpretations of Zhentong. And this, along with David Higgins' piece, and then pieces that I'll get to in a moment, really bring to light some of this disparate views within the broader Nyingma tradition. And in particular, Matthew Kapstein focuses his work or his paper on Lochen Dharma Sri, rather, and the thought around Zhentong and Rongtong distinctions within the Nyingma system, according to a text that he wrote. Next, we have Douglas Duckworth, who does a paper on Mipham. So we have two papers on Mipham in here, him along with Dorje Wangchuk. And Mipham Jamso is one of the critical Nyingma thinkers on Zhentong. And the two of them, both Douglas Duckworth and Dorje Wangchuk, present different views on Mipham's thinking around different issues concerning Zhentong. And from that, we have a paper by Marc-André Desroches on Rime discourses around Zhentong, and in particular, Jamyong Kontrol and Jamyong Kinsey Wangpo's presentations of Zhentong and how they use Zhentong as a platform for Rime thinking and the Rime discourses at the turn of the century. And then the last piece, last chapter in the volume, is one by myself in which I talk about Kenpo Loje Drakpa in the Jonang scholastic renaissance in the 20th century, and how through the revival of thinkers, largely based on work set in motion by Jamyong Kontrol, and before that by Katong Sewol Norbu, we have a renaissance of thinkers who are Jonang and who have been now in Amdo by that time, from the 17th century, but even before, and have a scholastic renaissance of sorts amongst the Jonangpa. So it really is a kind of whole vision, a whole kind of arc, not to say that we're all inclusive of all Zhentong thinkers, but you get to see a kind of arc of the trajectory of different types of thinkers through the volume.
So I guess there's two things going on here. There's the Tibetan thinkers interpreting the original Indian works, and then there's also Tibetan thinkers interpreting earlier Tibetan thinkers and trying to bring that all together in their arguments. Can you say a little bit more about how they do this and what comes out of that? That's fascinating.
Well, that's a very good question. And up to now, we were just presenting Zhentong as if there was just a Zhentong view, or just one way of how something ultimate can be empty of something which does not belong to it. But in fact, there are different types of Zhentong. And I started to realize that when I started to study Taranatha's analysis of Shakya Chogden and Dolpopa. And the main difference between the two according to Taranatha, but also like when you go to the works of Dolpopa and Shakyachokten themselves, that can be confirmed, is that the ultimate for Dolpopa is really something transcendent. It's beyond space and time, and it's permanent in the sense that it's outside of time. And and the relative is everything else. It's so the dependent arising does not belong to the ultimate truth for Dolpopa and also other Chonangpas. That's something really important to remember when you talk about Chonang Shentong. Whereas for Shakyachokten and also some of the Kakyu authors, like the 7th and the 8th Kamapa and others, like Kongtrul Lotre Taye, they have a different idea of what the basis of negation is. So they start from a kind of non-dual wisdom, which is still inside space and time. It's also permanent, but only like a permanent in the sense of a continuous flow. Yeah, it's just the Dharmakaya or the Buddha nature, which becomes the Dharmakaya. It remains in samsara as long as there are suffering sentient beings and which need help. So only in this sense it remains and is permanent. But it is still a kind of dynamic principle, which continues in a continuous flow. So, Taranatha just summarizes Shakyachokten's view as for him the non-dual wisdom, the ultimate wisdom, is still a kind of possessing moments, whereas for Dolpopa it does not, and that's directly related also to how you interpret the three nature model of Yogacara. Maybe I should say a few things about it. In Yogacara philosophy, the mind has three different natures or three different aspects. First of all, it is the dependent nature of our dependently arising mind, our mind stream, which continues, but as something dependently arising. And it contains imprints and seeds. These seeds and imprints cause the dualistic appearance of a perceived object and a perceiving subject. And in the sense that there is no external material world, but it's only a projection of a mind stream, which is in a mode of false imagining. And now the Yogacaras normally say, what is real is this dependently arising mind. It's a dependent nature, and it's empty of the wrongly imagined duality. And they use the example of the snake and the rope. So you walk at dawn in a jungle, you see a coiled up rope, and you're afraid, a snake. So the coiled up rope would be the dependent nature. It's really there. But your wrong perception of the rope as a snake, that would be the imagined nature. So you would, the Yogacara would say the rope is empty of snakehood. Yeah. So that what is really there, the dependently arising mind, is empty of the wrongly imagined duality. And the perfect nature would be just the dependent nature empty of the imagined nature. That would be the a more standard way of Shentong in Yogacara. But then you have alternatively a different model which favors the Buddha nature idea, which is empty of adventitious stains. And when you relate Buddha nature idea to the three nature model, you have to accommodate also the dependent nature in the adventitious stains. What is negated is then not only the imagined nature, but also that which causes it, so to say, the dependent nature. And then you end up with a model having the perfect nature, which is equal to the Buddha nature, and this is empty of the imagined and the dependent. So that already, constituted two different models of Shentong, and you had that already in India. And you can imagine that by the time these different models reached Tibet, they were further differentiated in models of Shentong emptiness. And This distinction between the original Yogacara Shentong, which is represented by Shakya Chogden, and the Buddha nature type of Shentong, where the Buddha nature is empty of imagined and dependent, as represented by Dolpopa, are the two main varieties of Shentong.
Yes. That's very clear. Thank you so much. And is there something, you know, in the way that the scholars who've contributed to this volume, in the way that they interpret the sources, that tell us a bit more about what you've just explained, but from kind of their interpretive perspectives?
Yeah, so Tibetans were wrestling with these problems, with these issues. And what we see here is an intellectual history and a literary history that gives, again, a kind of arc to these problems. And there's not, you know, a solution to how to resolve some of these problems and puzzles. In fact, what we find are Tibetan thinkers who are working within the confines of a tradition, an intellectual tradition, a literary tradition, a cultural tradition that's Buddhist. And yet creativity is emergent in their thought, right? So there's this kind of tension between holding the forms of the tradition and the scripture, you know, the canonical kind of sources and so forth. And at the same time, understanding that there are interpretive modes and there are creative and ways of expressing this. And there's new language that can be evolved in these kind of expressions. And we find this through thinkers all the way up through the Tibetan tradition. And I think that each of the exemplary chapters in this volume speak to that kind of creativity of Tibetan thinking and that kind of, again, sort of wrestling with ideas, because there's this inherent tension between that which is empty because it's temporary and it's tangible and it's observably empty, right? It lacks an intrinsic identity. And that is there, and it's part of Buddhist understanding of the nature of things. And yet there's also this understanding that there's something other than what's empty, right? There's something that's continuous. There's something that's constant. There's something that's luminous. And that gets called the great emptiness, right? The Zhentong, that which is empty of everything other than that. So how do you reconcile these? And as Klaus was explaining, there's different models that come from the Indic literature, but also that were used, employed, and commentated upon by the Tibetans to sort of reconcile these tensions. And yet there's also a complementarity, because for the Zhentong thinkers, it's not like there's no Rongtong, right? It's not that Rongtong doesn't exist. There's no denial of the intrinsically empty nature of temporary tangible phenomena. No, not at all. In fact, what they're saying is that there's a whole complementarity here and that we need to look at. And that was very much from Dolpopa onward, certainly, the project. And then there become different hermeneutical frames and interpretive ways of thinking and writing, expressing, communicating that. But nonetheless, there are, again, these kind of intrinsic puzzles that they're working through around relative and ultimate nature of things. And how is that reconciled experientially through contemplation, through meditative experience, let alone through the kind of everyday observable phenomena. So what we find here is a kind of history of a problem, and people throughout the Tibetan intellectual tradition really finding ways to think through these issues.
Thank you. Yes.
So it's, one should maybe also add that The Chonanpas restrict the emptiness of self or the Rangtong to the level of relative truth. And that's, of course, in the eyes of the Gelugpas, it would be something outrageous. They would never accept that. I mean, so there are really different camps, and there has been a lot of discussion backward and forward going on. But, well, the whole thing is that, like, we have a Tibetan Buddhist canon, the Kanchur and the Tenchur, the words of the Buddha, which includes, according to the Tibetan tradition, also like the Mahayana texts and teachings and the Tantras. And then you have all these Indian commentaries from different camps. You know, you have the Madhyamaka, the pure Madhyamakas. Then you have the different types of Yogacara. Then you have Buddha nature sutras and teachings. Then you have the Tantras, like the Kalachakra, with the concept of a primordial Buddha, that you are already a fully developed Buddha throughout beginningless time. Now, you know, like, how do you bring that all together? So, like, if this is all the word of the Buddha, and if, all these commentaries are valid, good commentaries by Indian, scholar practitioners, so how do you explain? And then you have different hermeneutical systems. You have the hermeneutics of Chandrakirti. You have the hermeneutics of the Yogacaras. You have the hermeneutics of the Buddha nature. So that's setting, you know, the rules of the game. And with that, you know, you have really different options. Yeah? And the goal is always to formulate one consistent, astringent teaching, which includes all the Buddha words. So that's the big aim always, you know, whether you follow Chandrakirti or whether you follow the Sandinamochana Sutra. You need to explain, if you decide to have a Shantong view, you need to be able to explain not only the Maitreya works and not only the Buddha nature and some Kalachakra passages which support you directly, but you need also to interpret the Prajnaparamita. You need to be able to interpret everything. And in on the other side, if you decide to go with Chandrakirti, then you have to explain why the Buddha taught a Buddha nature and all that, and how could Buddha nature all the same mean Rangtong. And you can see that given the complexity of parameters, different forms of interpretations can develop. And basically that happened in Tibet. So you have right from the beginning of the second diffusion of Buddhism, and probably already much earlier, as David Higgins has shown in his article, different varieties of explaining the whole corpus of Buddhist teaching.
So another thing that jumped out at me was the extensiveness of the notes for each of the chapters, which for me was very useful in looking at, you know, the sources, pointing me in different directions to kind of look into that more in the original sources. So do you have a vision for how you'd want this book used for research, for teaching out in the world, that now it's there?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, this is something that Klaus and I discussed throughout the project, and along with our editors at SUNY. And there was a point before this book, not too long ago, where there was no source book to study Shantong in an undergraduate or graduate seminar on Buddhist philosophy or world thought, etc., and let alone, you know, Tibetan philosophy. And we thought one of the things we want to accomplish is to present serious scholarship on this topic from a variety of international scholars who are thinking through different Tibetan issues and exemplary figures. But we also want to make it accessible to undergraduate audiences, to graduate audiences who are learning Tibetan, as well as to specialists. So we did our best to really provide names and phonetics, for instance, but dump a lot of the annotated information, including Wiley for text and, you know, transliteration for Tibetan and so on and so forth, all the technical notes into EndNotes so that none of that is lost. And people who are interested in doing graduate work or scholarship in general have this resource book. But it's also something that somebody who is teaching in an undergraduate university who wants to have some representation of Tibetan thought can pull a chapter or can use the whole volume. And we thought it was important that there be a source book for studying Zhentong for people who are students as well as scholars.
I think you successfully did that, at least from my understanding of the book so far. So congratulations.
And practitioners as well. I cannot tell you how often, you know, I have people who are just interested in Zhentong, want to learn something about the Jonang or so on and so forth, and they'll email me. And I mean, it's I'm sure Klaus is the same. There's such a hunger amongst you know, Dharma practitioners to learn more. And we wanted to give them something that they could read as well, because there's so little published on these topics in the English language.
Yeah, it's definitely a very much needed study and book, and especially for practitioners who meditate, because like when you talk about the ultimate qualities, which are not empty, you need to have some kind of like meditation experience. So it talks to a meditator. You see, like when you are doing philosophy and you analyze, you're in a conceptual mind frame. And so you're still caught in a subject-object duality, even though you might have a very subtle like model of reality. You're still caught in this conceptual mind. But like when you meditate and like have some glimpses of Dzogchen or Mahamudra experience, then you also experience emptiness. And then when you after you have established or you see that everything lacks an independent existence and is empty, then what? You know, like are you then in a vacuum? Is there a complete nothingness? And no, you know, there is a kind of a luminous presence, a luminous awareness, a pristine awareness, which emerges. That, you know, can be accessed only like if you go beyond duality, and it is inexpressible. So like when you talk about that, like you reify, you there's a danger to reify it. So, okay, you know, like you could say you better don't talk about it at all. But, you know, like you can say, look, you know, like I can still try to use language to communicate, which is inexpressible. And that's basically what the Buddha did, right? When you go look at the Lalita Vistara Sutra, it says, well, the Buddha said, I have found such a profound Dharma, so wonderful, but I won't be able to teach it to anybody. I better go to the forest and stay quiet. And then, you know, all the story, then Indra and Brahma came, please teach, please, you know, turn the wheel of the Dharma. And then the Buddha, for the remaining 45 years of his life, he was traveling around in India, and he was teaching what is inexpressible. So that's the beginning of the Buddhist teaching, if you want. Yeah, and this question, you know, of an ultimate, of a luminous Buddha nature, which is empty of the adventitious, that's very much relevant for every Buddhist, and especially for those who practice.
Yes, that's correct. And I really hope this will achieve everything that you just talked about. And I think both of you mentioned when we started today that you both had an interest in understanding reality, and that's kind of some of your initial interest into this topic. So along your journey, reading these texts and interpreting them and also writing this book and editing the volume, do you feel like some of those questions have been answered about what reality is through this discourse?
Well, I think yes. Everybody just contributed from the study of his or her author and nicely presented the early Nyingmapas or the Kakyupas and the Chonangpas had to say about this topic. And it's a wonderful volume expressing different views on Shantong. And of course, you know, we have to continue doing research on the Chunang school and the Shantong position. And that's what we are also doing at the moment here in Vienna. We just started a new project with my research assistant, Filippo Brambilla, and Kempo Tampel, who is a Trikong Kakyu master, but working for us in the Shantong project on the Chunang Pass. And we are working also together with like Kempos in Tsamtang and in Golok. And so we are looking at how the Kalachakra Tantra and its Indian commentaries, the Vimala Prabha, can be used as a doctrinal basis for the Shantong view. And we just started this new project, and there's so much more to discover and to analyze. And I think in the future, there will be more information on Chunang and Shantong.
Yes, so much, very, very much look forward to it. And Michael, I know the center at UVA probably has a lot to do with this in the future.
So on reality, I think that, you know, what we're learning, I think, is the diversity of views that the Tibetans had on even, you know, one single topic, what people have thought, even scholars, Western scholars have thought, was a kind of monolithic presentation by Tibetans. And we're learning that that's not at all the case. There's a wide variety of presentations and perspectives and discourses at play in the history of Tibetan thought. And reality is that, right? It's multi-perspectival. And so I think that this volume represents that, at least in the vein of thinking, philosophical thinking around Shantong. As far as sort of projects on the horizon for me, yeah, here at UVA, we have a project that we're undertaking to look at contemplative traditions and through models and methodologies that David Germano and I have developed for looking at contemplative literature, particularly practice instruction, guidance texts, procedural instructions, etc., and how Tibetans have organized, structured, thematized contemplation. And in so doing, our project sort of thinks through, theorizes, and has interpretive frameworks for what we call contemplative literacy. And the idea of contemplative literacy is something that we can discover, something that we can unpack through analysis and interpretation. So again, we're developing models and methods for doing that across different contemplative practices and traditions, Tibetan. And then my own work on the Jonang, outstanding at the moment, is a monograph that I have had in the works, which will be an intellectual history of the Jonang tradition. And that's something I've been working on for some years, and I have to be bringing it to fruition in the coming year. So.
Well, we'd love to have you back once it's out.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes, and both of you, thank you so much for being with us here today. And I know we've taken up quite a lot of your time already on a Friday, so very much appreciated. And good luck with all of your future work. And right, very much look forward to having you both back at some point for your future works.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you also so much for your very good questions and for organizing this interview. Thank you so much, Sensei Rama.